Last time we spoke of how the nation of Spain emerged, and with it a national cuisine centered on the court. Spain developed a cooking style that was comparatively simple and straightforward at the noble level, because there really was no rising middle class able to imitate the nobles. And it was also paradoxically one that used sugar and spices at the lower levels of society because they were cheap and affordable, along with New World products like tomatoes eventually, because no one else wanted to use them. But just as Italy passed culinary leadership to Spain in the early 17th century, France took the lead in the mid-17th century. But first of all, what do I mean by leadership? I mean, literally dozens of cookbooks were produced. In this lecture, we'll sample from cookbooks by four of the giants responsible for the creation of early French haute cuisine. And beyond the sheer number of cookbooks, the French took the lead in ways that they innovate, either by creating new recipes and techniques, or by creating new fashions that are imitated elsewhere. And by that criteria, France is indisputably the leader from the mid-17th all the way through the mid-18th century. Everyone in Europe imitates French fashion, architecture, language, diplomacy, and indisputably, cooking. We will talk today about how and why that happens. France is perhaps the model of how nation-states are constructed in the early modern period. It becomes territorially intact. The power of the king becomes greater than that of any of his nobles. And it has a national army paid for by taxes. France is therefore one of the first countries to have a monopoly on violence. And that, according to one classic theory put forward by sociologist Norbert Elias, is why manners really appear in Europe. Now remember how knives at the table could be seen as threatening? Making them rounded and eating with a fork and eventually ritually defining polite behavior to prevent misunderstanding or arguments. Well, Elias links these directly to the domestication of nobles and the monopolization of violence by the state. In other words, when you're at court, you have to behave. Thus, noble warriors have become courtiers. France is also one of the first states to get a rational bureaucracy staffed by salaried officials to make governing more efficient. So it's not exactly a modern bureaucracy, since nobles often buy the government positions. But in any case, they're not fighting anymore. And they're sitting around, they're enjoying themselves, they're collecting revenues while professional armies do the real dirty work now. And keep in mind also, in France, the nobles are also tax exempt. And they still collect all sorts of fees that are really the remnants of feudalism. So like in Spain, there is a class of people with a lot of money to spend. But there is also, most importantly, a wealthy middle class. And we're talking merchants, townsmen, wealthy farmers that provide vegetables or cheeses or wine to the cities. And this is a very important distinction to be made. This class will be especially important in the 18th century, and especially when we get to the French Revolution, too. But the question is, why did France have a bourgeoisie when Spain didn't? I think it has to do mostly with government policy. You see, Spain spent a fortune fighting wars, mostly over religion. And they also thought that since they had all this silver coming from the New World, that they could just spend as much as they wanted and never run out. They were, in fact, mistaken. And they do eventually run out of cash. And combined with a bad tax policy and depopulation and all these rights granted to nobles, and of course some incompetent kings very poorly advised by greedy ministers, that makes a bad situation for Spain. But France has none of these. The wars were fought only for profit, and they won those wars that they got involved in. And they had a series of excellent kings with brilliant ministers. And the state consciously sponsored trade and industry and crafts and agriculture, fully realizing that if the wealth doesn't get spread around, it's kind of like blood. It clots. It gets stuck in one organ when it really needs to circulate throughout the entire body to be useful. Now, why the efflorescence of France occurs only in the 17th century really has to do largely with a series of disastrous civil wars in the 16th century that are mostly over religion. Thus, the period when Italy and when Spain are flourishing artistically, the French court was, for the most part, stagnating. There were practically no cookbooks written, and what we know of French fashion and cookery is that it was still, for the most part, medieval. In fact, the cookbook of Théobald, written a few centuries before, back in the 1300s, was the first French cookbook printed, and it gets reprinted through the 16th century. But there is one very interesting little cookbook published, that I'm translating actually right now. It's in the 16th century. This is the Livre for Excellence de Cuisine, the little great book on cooking. And it's fairly obscure, but the only account we have of dining in the later 16th century, apart from that one, describes the court of Henry III. And it's really a bizarre account. It's a satire called The Description of the Isle of Hermaphrodites, because apparently Henry liked to wear makeup and dress up like a woman and so forth. But most interestingly, it says that everything was designed to shock and surprise, and that these effeminate courtiers had the audacity to use forks. So they're new, really, in France. But all of that changes when we get to the 17th century. First, the civil wars come to an end with the reign of Henry IV. He converted to Catholicism and declared religious toleration. And he was succeeded by Louis XIII, you probably know of him if you're a Three Musketeers fan. This is the period when his prime minister is Cardinal Richelieu, and all those stories you hear about court intrigue and cloak and dagger conspiracies and such, they're sort of true. But Richelieu did effectively increase the power of the crown at the expense of the nobles, and that's our theme today. But the ruler I would like to focus on today is Louis XIV, the Sun King, who ruled from 1643 all the way to 1715. And more than any preceding ruler, Louis knew that to rule absolutely, he had to bring those nobles directly under his watchful eye. And he did this by building the grandest palace Europe had ever seen. This is Versailles. And by forcing all the leading dignitaries, the officials, the churchmen, the nobles to come live there with him. And Versailles was not just a palace. It was an entire city staffed by thousands of chefs, servants, suppliers, gardeners of the royal orchards, vegetable beds, an entire army led by what were called the officiers de la bouche, the officers of the mouth. And practically every single day, daily occurrence was at court governed by complex, formalized public ritual, and especially eating. And again, think why. Manners pacify people. They prevent misunderstanding. They prevent outbreaks of violence. Now, this is not to say that in private, the courtiers didn't wage their own little political battles behind the scenes. And the place, you know, sometimes Versailles seems like a drunken orgy. But, you know, imagine all these people cooped up together, men and women, with not much to do but entertain themselves. And I think it's no surprise, really, that they raised the arts to an unprecedented level. The plays of Racine and Corneille and Molière, the artists and landscape architects like Le Nôtre, the composers like Lully. This was a fantastic place for arts to flourish, and I am not excluding cooking here. Now, let me give you, before we start in on Louis XIV, a little anecdote, and it's one of the most famous stories in the history of food. It involves a chef who had worked in the households of some of the leading nobles in France, and finally for the Prince de Condé. And the chef's name is Vatel. The story is told by Madame de Sévigné, and it takes place in 1671. And King Louis XIV had come to visit Condé out at his country estate, the Château de Chantilly. And of course, he had to be entertained in style. And as it turns out, one night there were not enough roasts to go on all of the tables because some unexpected guests showed up. So the 25th table down had no roast. And Vatel was absolutely humiliated. He was beside himself. And Condé comes to assure him that everything is fine, don't worry. And the next day, 4 a.m. on a Friday, so he has to serve fish, remember, Vatel is running around preparing for the next day already, and he meets this fish supplier who has only 2 loads of fish. And Vatel says, this is all there is? And the guy says, yeah. Now, he didn't know that there were tons of fish ordered, but Vatel assumed that this is all the fish for the whole entire feast to feed hundreds of people. So he goes up to his room, steadies a sword against the door and ran it through his heart. And it actually took three times, apparently. But he's found dead, lying there in a puddle of blood. And immediately thereafter, the cartloads of fish he ordered start to arrive. So why is this period so important in the history of cuisine? Well, it's here that what we call modern French classical or haute cuisine was born. Although it's really not called haute cuisine until much later, but that's what it is. But when I use the term classical, I mean it in a very specific sense. So let me digress here for just a moment, because I think it will explain how and why cooking changes as it does. There are some periods in art history that might be called Dionysian, or at least this is what the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche calls them. And it's a period when it's a period when rules are broken, wild individual experimentation takes place, standard ways of doing things are overturned. So say the Romantic period of the 19th century is one of those. This here is not. This is mid-17th century to mid-18th century. France is what we might call Apollonian. It's a period when rules are made, strict procedures are developed, great systems are thought of and constructed. And it's not coincidental that the scientific revolution happens at the same time. René Descartes is constructing his philosophical and mathematical systems. Playwrights are defining exactly how a tragedy should be constructed. And of course, composers are defining rules for how an opera should be performed or what a ballet should look like. Those are both developed in this century. And cookbook authors are defining what elegant cooking should be like and how to do it. Now, it doesn't happen overnight, and there's no sudden radical break with the past. But in codifying cuisine and making rules, it does seem something totally different, and something uniquely French, to pick up my theme about national cuisines and nationalism, happens to be starting here. So for the remainder of this lecture, we're going to focus on French cookbooks that revolutionized culinary history and set the context for a variety of cuisines that follows. So the first cookbook to make a decisive break, so historians claim, is Le Cuisinier François by François-Pierre de la Varenne, published in 1651, there was a translation into English just a few years later. The essence of this new cuisine lies in the fact that foods are increasingly cooked in a way that accentuates and intensifies the flavor of the main ingredient rather than contrast with it, as the sugar, spices, and vinegar of older cookbooks had. Sauces are more often bound with a roux made of flour and fat, rather than breadcrumbs, rather than sharp flavorings. And also, an increasing number of sauces are based on butter, okay? Herbs are used to add a subtle flavor to a sauce. A consommé is clarified with egg whites. And equally important is the procedural logic of La Varenne's recipes. A few basic preparations, such as a rich stock, can be kept on hand, reduced, that is, boiled to evaporate away some of the water, and then used to make a whole variety of other sauces and accompaniments for other dishes. It's a fond, basically. Now, many of the older standbys are still there. You know, there's still exotic birds and game, large fish. But some of these things begin to disappear. And it would take time, but spices increasingly are banished to desserts, where, of course, we still find them today. And even though many late 17th century recipes still do contain spices, judging from contemporaries' comments, the French use spices far more sparingly than elsewhere. And now that the middle classes could afford these spices, they're no longer marks of wealth and sophistication. Pepper began to be used more universally as a seasoning, of course, as it is to this day. And cinnamon, it just kind of is used much more rarely. Other spices disappear entirely and, of course, have remained scarce ever since. Things like mace, long pepper, cardamom, saffron. And fresh herbs and aromatics take their place, onions, mushrooms. The new culinary aesthetic stresses subtlety, simplicity of preparation, and a logical order to the food served. You know, this abundance and huge piles of sugar and, you know, meat, and that kind of impressed less now than the correct way of organizing a meal. Good taste had replaced what to older generations merely tasted good. Now, naturally, it took years to break away from ingrained culinary habits, and in La Varenne, there are still many medieval recipes lingering around. But the procedures have changed. Salt and pepper, sometimes cloves a little, they season along with aromatics. Meat is floured and seared. Sauces are reduced. And all of this stuff begins to presage what will follow in the years to come. But let me take a look at one of his recipes, and I think this demonstrates these changes. It's a recipe for braised lamb that he calls veal epigram, which is legs or knuckles of veal. And the translation, this is from the English translation, made in 1653. A whitening procedure, what's called blanching or soaking, is done in cold water that removes blood or impurities from the meat. So, after they are well whitened in fresh water, flour them and pass them into the pan with melted lard or fresh seam. And seam is just rendered pork fat. Lard tends to be drippings. Then break them and put them in a pot well seasoned with salt, pepper, cloves, and a bundle of herbs, and put an onion with it, a little broth, a few capers, then flour them and some paste, and smother them with the pot lid. Seethe them leisurely, thus covered for the space of 3 hours, after which you shall uncover them and shall reduce your sauce until it be all be better thereby. Put some mushrooms to it, if you have any, then serve. Now, the eventual impact of La Varenne's new approach to French cuisine would stretch across all of Europe. But let's turn to a very simple recipe for stewed salmon. And it appears right after a recipe for ragout of salmon that includes sugar, which makes it a good example of how salty flavors have begun to replace the sweet ones. It also shows how a reduced wine and butter sauce that accentuates the main ingredient has replaced a sour sauce that was in previous years thought to cut through the gluey humors of the fish. But here's a recipe given in modern English. And incidentally, as La Varenne points out, salmon goes really nicely with red or white wine. So it's a stewed salmon. Cut into slices the thickness of 2 or 3 fingers and stick them with cloves, the way stews are done, in a pot with white or red wine, well seasoned with butter, salt, and chopped onion. Cook it with capers if you have any. Let the sauce reduce and thicken and serve garnished with whatever you like. There's also an absolutely simple, straightforward recipe for fried artichokes. And this reflects La Varenne's respect for the clarity and pureness of flavors. You know, in earlier generations, artichokes would have been sprinkled with cinnamon or sugar or probably swathed with some kind of sauce. He says, trim them as you do for a poivrade, a pepper sauce. Also, remove the sharp points. Blanch them in hot water. After that, dry them, flour them. When you need them, serve them garnished with fried parsley. Another book, Le Cuisinier by Pierre de Lune, appears shortly after La Varenne. That's 1656. And de Lune is credited with introducing several further technical innovations. The making regular use of a bouquet garni, a bundle of herbs, you know, that's bound and used for flavoring stocks and stews. And one of the earliest set of directions for making a roux with flour, which he calls fried flour. De Lune was chef to the Duke of Rohan, and so his recipes reflect, again, the best that money could buy, which now meant refinement, elegant procedures, rather than rare exotic ingredients, variety, or abundance. So take, for example, this mushroom stock, in which a simple ingredient is raised to a higher level as it becomes the base or garnish for other recipes, such as the one that follows. This is the method for extracting true mushroom juice to use in meat and vegetable dishes. Clean the mushrooms well, put them in a pan with a bit of bacon, let them brown on the embers until they stick to the bottom of the pan. Being brown, put them in flour and let them brown. Being done, put in a good bouillon, remove the mushrooms from the fire, and place the juice in another pot seasoned with a bit of lemon and salt. And you can also make the same juice without meat by placing butter in the bottom of the pan in place of the bacon. And the mushrooms you can serve finely chopped, cut or whole, in soups, in entrees, or in side dishes. Now let's turn to a recipe for crayfish soup. That's another good example of how chefs sought to intensify and concentrate the main flavor of the ingredient and garnish it with other foods that complement it as well as decorate the plate. And here it's roe or fish eggs and mushrooms. Presentation and pleasing the eye was clearly just as important to de Lune as subtly matching these flavors. Now consider how different approach this is than the spiced sugar, vinegar-laden fish sauces of the previous century. So here's a crayfish soup. Wash the crayfish well, cook them in water with a bundle of herbs, a bit of salt, and butter. Then draw out the tails and legs and pound the shells, which you strain with the crayfish bouillon, and place in a pot. Then you put the tail and leg meat in a pan with a bit of butter and fine herbs, well chopped, and you place them in a pot or plate with the bouillon, the reddest you can strain. After, simmer bread crusts with the bouillon, 3 or 4 finely chopped mushrooms, arrange your crayfish, and garnish the soup with the roe and the mushrooms, lemon juice, and mushroom juice. Delicious. So among the late 17th century French cookbooks, L'Art de Bien Traiter of 1674 is the largest, most innovative, and important, and its author was also a professional chef working for the noblest of patrons. We don't know his name, though. It's LSR, just those initials. We know nothing more about him. But he's usually remembered today for scathing remarks about the vulgarity of earlier cookbooks. In fact, Lavarenne's Teal Soup à la Hippocras, Larks in Sweet Sauce, Fried Calves Heads and Turkey Stuffed with Raspberries, these all struck LSR as the most backward and revolting things imaginable. They come right out of Lavarenne. And he even ridicules that veal epigram dish we just discussed. But far more interesting are the ways that LSR anticipates developments in haute cuisine yet to come. His detailed interest in sensory perceptions, the way the food looks and feels in the mouth, the subtle perfumes evoked by perfect cooking. His aim here is delicacy and refinement and discernment. And LSR instructed his readers exactly how to get these effects. Moreover, the foods should taste of themselves, not an infinity of flavors competing in the mouth. And perhaps more than any other chef of this generation, LSR achieves that cool refinement and balance and proportion that is sought out by the architects and the gardeners and the playwrights of Versailles. As he himself says, it is not abundance, strange meats, or a jumble of spices, but the exquisite choice of meats, the refinement of their seasoning, the politeness and the propriety of their service, their quantity proportionate to the number of guests, and finally, the general order of things that are essential to the goodness and ornament of a meal. And the refinement of LSR's cookbook was, of course, achieved in large measure by distancing himself from the culinary fashions of a common rabble, and especially those of previous generations. But let me give you a few brief, obnoxious comments that I'll read to you in a second. I think they illustrate how he achieved this distance. They're on the first page of his section about roasting, and he mentions the petit bourgeois. Roughly, that means lower middle class, but it implies people who've sort of recently acquired wealth and kind of want to fit into their new social class by imitating others, like parrots in this case, okay? So this is fat lamb. When it is nearly cooked, place on it only fine salt, and do not bind yourself to those base maxims of the petit bourgeois with their breadcrumbs, which only suck up the substance and the juice of the meat. And regarding the infinite quantity of chopped parsley that is customarily put on, even on veal and mutton, I counsel you, leave this useless ornament on this occasion for Mr. Parrot, to whom it is given as food and which makes the most delicate part of his daily nourishment. So, the most popular cookbook of the latter 17th century is Masaya Lowe's Le Cuisinier Royal et Bourgeois of 1691. And Masaya Lowe probably worked as a freelance caterer for the royal household, and really whoever could afford his services. But his connections at court and the descriptions of meals he cooked there make this cookbook an enormous success. And its popularity, I think it has to do with the fact that it's addressing a much broader audience. It is at once royal, but would also appeal to city dwellers, merchants, wealthy members of the middle class who can make many of these recipes. They're on a smaller scale, yeah, but I think it's interesting that this was reissued several times, and there's an expanded version in the middle of the 18th century. It blossoms out to 3 volumes, in fact. Although in many ways, you know, this book is not as modern as LSR. And in fact, he borrows recipes even from de Lune much, much earlier before. But it marks a significant advance in culinary literature. For one single reason, it's arranged alphabetically. So you can actually you want to make a recipe, you open it up and you look for it like an encyclopedia. In terms of technique, several features of classical haute cuisine also come into full light here. There's extensive use of reduced stocks that are bound with a liaison of butter or cream or eggs, sometimes garnished with expensive ingredients like truffles or foie gras. And the focus is really on concentrating flavors and reducing them to a kind of essence. And in this respect, the cooking here is analogous to chemistry, which also sought to refine basic substances into their essential components. But one also finds humbler ingredients and simpler cuts of meat, and they're treated with, let's just call it respect, and they're cooked with ways that are very straightforward, that aren't messed with or fussed with, and can actually let the flavor of the main ingredient shine forth. In fact, when planning an entire dinner, you have all these fonds made ahead of time, or let's call them flavor bases, that would have been prepared by a very large kitchen staff. So we're talking about many men, a whole team whose job is just to reduce down these stocks into fonds. And the flavor bases you can use then as the building blocks for making lots of other sauces. Or you can add it to a braise or a ragu. And in fact, a ragu originally means to ragouter, to jumpstart the palate or start it again, to retaste. And it later comes, of course, to mean a ragu, like a sauce in Italy. But this is one of the most important organizing principles of French cuisine from that time right down to the present, is you have a whole battery of things on which other recipes are based. However, it's interesting to note that he offers another simpler version of the same recipe as well, saying those who don't have the means to make a coulis can serve it by adding a bit of flour when the onions color before moistening it, so the flour has a little time to cook. He also specifies the use of a proper stove. Rather than using pots arranged in a fire, he's actually got hobs on which these pots are sitting. And haute cuisine, high cuisine for this period, it begins to define the arrangements of all the culinary equipment, things in a kitchen that we would really take for granted now. It begins to say what you need exactly when and why. Remember, a rule-making period. The culinary achievements of the 17th century, largely aristocratic and royal, would continue right through the 18th century. And in fact, there are dozens of new cookbooks. And France really dominates haute cuisine throughout Europe everywhere. To give you an example of this, Vincent La Chapelle has connections to the Netherlands, but he eventually makes his way to France, where he learns how to cook, and then over to England and works at the royal court there. And that's one way these recipes make their way to England. Maybe François Marin is the quintessential 18th century figure who introduces something that he calls nouvelle cuisine. The idea is that the food would be much more refined, much more concentrated, and there wouldn't be extraneous anything on the plate. It would be kind of a concentrated essence of flavor, and you wouldn't see anything else that was put into it. His Don de Calmus, in fact, this is an introduction written by two Jesuit priests, but they say that the science of cooking consists in refining, breaking down, and reducing meats to their essence, drawing nourishing juices and yet remaining light, and mixing them together so that nothing dominates and everything can be tasted. Can you see how this is a kind of, it's sort of parallel to what happens with nouvelle cuisine when we get to the 60s and 70s. It's an idea that you just simplify, take out all the extraneous elements, and focus right in on the ingredients themselves. And we'll come back to that when we get to the 20th century. But in this lecture, we've seen how early French haute cuisine marks the beginning of several things that really we still experience every day in cooking. The whole way we think about sugar and spices as separate from savory foods and banished to desserts, that's something that really is the invention of 17th, 18th century France. We saw pepper become a staple flavoring on every table that is sort of there just in case you want to spice up things, but the rest of the spices kind of disappear for the most part. We also saw herbs, onions, and mushrooms replace all those spices that are now considered more exotic. And I think the other very important thing to remember is the structure of the meal, the whole idea that you start with things that are lightly flavored, you progress to soups, then to fish, then to meat, and then only at the end do you get something sweet. That idea really comes directly out of French haute cuisine, and of course it influences lots of other cuisines as well. So when we pick up this story again, we'll see truly revolutionary developments. I mean, I'm talking literally and figuratively, French Revolution. But before we do that, let's turn in our next lecture to England, because its culinary history, I think, is really underappreciated and misunderstood today.